Just take a look around. Darkness rules the earth. Governments crumble. Chaos reigns. There is opportunity in chaos.
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Greetings, heroes and villains alike, and welcome to another action-packed episode of Junk Food Cinema right here on FilmSchoolRejects.com. This is the weekly cult and exploitation film cast that is so good, it just has to be fattening. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and joining me, as per usual, is my friend and co-host. He's a novelist, he's a screenwriter, he's one of the writers of Marvel's upcoming Doctor Strange, he is C. Robert Cargill.
And he's a lieutenant in Megaforce.
And he's a lieutenant in goddamned Megaforce.
And tonight, we're going to punch evil. Wrestle evil.
Nope, not
we're
taking the bait.
We're going to tickle evil.
Not taking the bait. I'm going to ignore you as I remind people.
Punch evil, Brian.
That this
punch
show,
evil.
At least for now, until I pull the plug on it entirely, is available on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. And hey, if you're going to iTunes, please rate and review us. It really, really carries weight.
Did you say rate?
Rate us.
Good.
We'll get into that later, Cargill. Rate us on iTunes because
see, some people are laughing going, getting into that later, huh? They have no idea what they are
no,
in for.
They really don't. But if you rate and review us on iTunes, it carries a lot of weight when those podcasts are ranked. The higher we're ranked, the more listeners we garner, so on and so forth. It's very
rate me. Very good for us.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah, rate us, my friend. On a personal note, before we get started, I just wanted to make a brief announcement. A friend of all of ours here in Austin, and when I say friend of ours, I'm not talking about the mafia. I'm talking about a cherished member of the Draft House / Fantastic Fest family. His name is Rocky Juarez. His wife was in a car accident several days ago and is currently in ICU. They have two kids, and Rocky himself has actually survived a bad car accident a few years ago. It's a really tragic situation. There's a GoFundMe online for Rocky's family for the mounting medical costs. Very good cause. We're directly helping out a true blue film geek who is truly one of us. We'll have a link on this page. Please consider donating to that, and we thank you very much.
And if you're not listening on the page, if you're listening through one of the other channels, you'll find links to that on both Brian and my Twitter feeds.
Very much so.
This guy in particular, what you need to know about Rocky is he's one of us, and by one of us, I don't mean like he's an Austinite, you know, just a member of that crowd. He's one of us. Like he is a hardcore movie fan. He's worked at a video store forever. He's one of those guys that whenever any Austin person has a book signing, reading, film screening, whenever an Austinite does something, you are guaranteed that Rocky's going to be there in the crowd cheering people on. He is one of the biggest and biggest hearted and most loving guys in the community. He's the type of person that you guys would sit down with for hours and just rap about movies about. He is such a great guy. And please, if you've got a couple bucks to toss in the hat, and I mean a couple bucks to toss in the hat, anything helps at this point.
Absolutely. Well, say it with me, folks.
Punch evil.
Slam evil.
A phrase that appears nowhere in the film.
It is one of the greatest taglines to any film ever. And that's right. This week, we're talking about the 90s filmic superhero who rocked the purple garb in a way that would impress his royal badness himself. Prepare for action. Prepare for adventure. Prepare for the insanity of the Phantom.
In a treacherous time, evil is a fact.
We shall succeed where they have failed.
Drax is on a quest for a supernatural power.
They know far too much.
And courage.
Stop them. You're the only one who can.
Is a Phantom.
Oh, yes.
You've been really excited about this one.
This is a movie I love so unabashedly that this is not even the first time that Junk Food Cinema has covered this movie. Oh, yes. Way back in the long, long ago, the all or nothing days, when this was just a written column, I covered this movie. I adore. This movie came out in the era when I was about 12 years old, or actually I was about 11, just because it was the summer of 96. And this was the era of the, we don't have the rights to the big guy superhero movies. So they were really culling all of the sort of oddball sources to get superhero movies made. And what that led to is almost every superhero movie of this era was a period piece. And I thought that was the coolest thing ever, mainly because I was such a huge nerd for Indiana Jones. And I think of all the period superhero movies, this one most directly rips off Indiana Jones. And that's not a bad thing. I think it works really well for it.
You want to talk about a movie that not only rips off Indiana Jones, it's Indiana Jones ripping off Batman.
Yeah.
It's one of those crazy movies that it shows its influences in a big way, even though it's a property that was at the time like 60 years old. Like, it was one of those things where Hollywood just went, how do we do this? I know. Let's, you know, they created the Reese's Peanut Butter Cup of superhero movies where it's like, hey, you got your Batman in my Indiana Jones. Hey, you got your Indiana Jones in my Batman. I got an idea. Let's put them in purple.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that is this movie. It is a crazy, crazy little piece. So you talk about this time when everybody was trying to make superhero movies. The thing is superhero movies weren't doing well. Like, there, you know, there are a couple small things, like Batman did well, and The Rocketeer did decently well at the time, despite the fact that it was not a
top tier comic. In fact, the comic itself hadn't been around that long when they made the movie.
It was a relatively new comic at the time. But there was a desire for adventure movies. Mm-hmm. And there was this kind of leftover period piece thing from the 80s that they were kind of calling back to that wasn't really connecting with people in the 90s, but we went with it because these were the adventure movies we had.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a really crazy time. I remember about a year or two after this, there was this really good article in Entertainment Weekly called Super Zero, which was all about Super Zero, Why Can't Hollywood Make a Good Superhero Movie?
Mm-hmm.
And it was all about the failures of all these superhero movies, and that Batman had unleashed a wave of superhero movies that, you know, this particular piece had been written in reaction to Spawn.
Spawn.
Oh, yeah. And the Phantom came up, and the Shadow, and a whole host of, you know, the various attempts over the previous decade. And this was one of those movies that I don't know how well it did, because I don't remember, but I know that it wasn't huge, and it was just kind of a weird little movie. I know I was there opening weekend. Like, mm-hmm. That was, of course, you know, we joke a lot about Slam Evil because it gets your rankles up quite a bit. You get very, very defensive about this movie. But
Slam Evil.
But it's true. Slam Evil got my ass into the theater. Now, the thing is, I knew who the Phantom was going in. And one of the things I was talking about earlier, but I don't know if you connected with it, but technically speaking, according to 80s, you know, the way the 80s worked, the Phantom is in the same universe as Flash Gordon. There was a cartoon show from the 80s.
The Defenders of the Earth.
Yes.
That's right.
And the Phantom, Flash Gordon, Mandrake the Magician.
Which was Mandrake the Magician, the creator of Mandrake the Magician also created the Phantom, so that makes sense.
Yeah. And so I love the fact, and this is something that's always been in my head.
Defenders of the Earth.
Lord of the Jungle, the hero who stalks. The beasts call him brother, the gods to war.
Phantom. Defenders of the Earth. Defenders.
There it is. Yeah. So since this movie takes place in the 30s and Flash Gordon takes place in the 70s, the Phantom is technically a prequel to Flash Gordon. But
mind's being blown.
Yes. But yeah, it's such a delightfully strange little movie.
It is very strange. It's strange even for a superhero movie. It is strange even for a superhero movie of this period, because what you basically have is you have Billy Zane already on his way to becoming a Junk Food Cinema All-Star, if for no other reason than his amazing performance in Tales from the Crypt Demon Knight, playing Kit Walker, who is basically bequeathed the mantle of the Phantom, who is this superhero in the sense that he is a guardian, a protector of the Bengala jungle. Bengala, by the way, is not a real country. But it is a...
For those of you that needed to know...
I'm just saying, in case you're like, oh, I'm going to book a trip to Bengala, Expedia.no. It turns out it doesn't exist. But so he is the protector of the Bengala jungle.
Hold on. You just found this out, didn't you?
Yeah, I did.
You were going to... You wanted to travel
maybe
to Bengala,
I wanted to go. Fuck you. Maybe I wanted to go to Bengala. Maybe I wanted to see what Bengalese money and culture look like and meet the roof people.
You were doubly heartbroken. You're like, fuck it, I'm going to go to Agrabah.
Agrabah exists. It just doesn't exist yet. That movie is post-apocalyptic. Anywho, look it up, guys. Anywho, so Kit Walker is the 21st iteration of the Phantom, dating back to a young boy whose father was killed by this pirating group called the Pirates of the Sang Brotherhood, and he was shipwrecked and washed up on this island called Tuganda, the Tuganda tribe picks him up and carries him to safety, and basically he is sworn in as the first Phantom, which, by the way, doesn't imbue him with any powers. And again, I think this is another Batman parallel, where he has no superpowers. He has to rely on his wits, his athleticism, and two very big guns.
And all of this money that he has. He's just another douchebag billionaire off to save the world.
Yes, absolutely. Well,
you know, I just have to say, this is one of those weird things from the 30s that I love, that it's just one of those weird throwbacks that in a post, in a post-crash economy during the 30s, mm-hmm. when, you know, all hell is broken loose and Wall Street has completely and totally destroyed this country, leave it to the press to give us a bunch of rich superheroes going out to use their money to save us. It's like one of the greatest propaganda campaigns in history.
And at the same time, the villains are equally rich, but somehow their riches make them evil. It's bizarre when you think about it, because all the heroes are rich, yeah, but they're defending the poor.
Defending the poor from the rich. So it's like the rich have nothing to do in the 30s but put on spandex and beat the crap out of each other.
Self-hating affluent. That's basically what's going on with a lot of the heroes of this era. And I'm going to trace everything, the origins of all these characters, kind of back to one source. And I think it's really interesting in my research. I think I've kind of discerned where a lot of these characters came from. But in the meantime, he's in the jungle. He runs afoul of these seeming treasure hunters. They're looking for this skull. The opening of this film, very much reminiscent of an Indiana Jones film. Except that it would be as if, the twist put on it, it would be as if Indy himself were the villain. Because you have these guys who go in and they plunder the cave and they get the artifact and they're running out. And instead of a boulder chasing them, it's Billy Zane in all of his violet glory astride a white horse, which the purple suit on the white horse in the jungle really helps him blend in.
You just really made it as Zoolander as possible.
I'm just saying.
It's Billy Zane.
It is that Billy Zane.
It's not even like early 90s Billy Zane. It's the violet glory astride a white horse.
Yes, it's almost too beautiful to look at, Billy Zane.
His smooth testicles up against the milky white mane of the horse.
Stop trying to turn me on. It is going to work. So, yeah, the opening is basically what would happen if Indiana Jones was the bad guy and you had to send someone to stop him from stealing the idol. But anyway, so all of this turns out to be the machinations of an evil billionaire named Xander Drax, who lives in New York and is trying to acquire the three skulls of Tuganda, which will give him the ultimate power. So having figured this out, Kit returns to New York, where he was educated, and runs into his old crush, Diana Palmer, and the two of them basically get entangled in this plot by Xander Drax to acquire the skulls, which basically has them ping-ponging across the planet, like from the jungle to New York, New York back to the jungle, so on, and from the jungle then back to New York.
Now, before we go further, we should mention...
We should?
The old flame is, yes, Christy Swanson.
Played by Christy Swanson.
Who, has a magical place in history, not only being the first Buffy the Vampire Slayer, mm-hmm. and in certain estimations, the only Buffy the Vampire Slayer, but also is her first appearance in a film is in a cameo that is, you know, that was from a reshoot of a classic movie that became like one of those defining moments and created her entire career. Her first moment on screen, she'd done television, but her first film was she plays the girl dancing that waves over Ducky at the end of Pretty in Pink, because the original ending of Pretty in Pink was depressing. And here they, you know, when they, in the reshoots, they decided to give Ducky, you know, a prize, a girl, like he waited out
and, a consolation girl,
and the consolation girl that he gets instead of Molly Ringwald is Christy fucking Swanson, who would then immediately go on to be, you know, the girl, that tells the really long winded story about Ferris Bueller fainting at a 31 Flavors in Ferris Bueller's Day Off. And of course here, this is when she's at the height of her career. She is on fire. She's in all these movies. She is a starlet in this era. Like she was a name on the poster. And this is the very end of that era.
Yeah. And it's of, and I was telling you this as we were watching it, revisiting it, it struck me that of my holy triumvirate of movies, of superhero movies from this era, that would be The Rocketeer, The Shadow, and The Phantom, she is undeniably the strongest female character in all three of those movies.
Absolutely.
She is a heroine. She's not a damsel at any point, even though she is kidnapped at one point. As soon as the Phantom shows up and unties her, she's like, okay, I can take it from here, and just goes off on her own. And he actually... he seems a little out of his element, you know, compared to her, because she is just like, she's very take charge, and he's wandering into fights that he doesn't see coming. And if not for the fact that he has a wolf named Devil, he would have totally gotten himself captured instead of rescuing her. And she has a great line in that moment where she says, he's like, we'll stick together, but I'll go first. And she says, well, go ahead. It's your rescue. And he kind of stops and looks at her. And it's this really great moment of turning the tables a little bit. And throughout the movie, she's very strong. And in fact, this movie's other female character, speaking of first appearances on film.
Oh, yeah.
Is Catherine Zeta-Jones.
Appearing under her previous name, Catherine Zeta-Jones.
That's true. Not Catherine Zeta-Jones Douglas, just yeah, Catherine no. Zeta-Jones.
I find that really amusing when you go to IMDb, because she's...
Billed as
Catherine Zeta-Jones with a hyphen, because this was back when she was using the hyphen. So this isn't Catherine Zeta-Jones. This is Catherine Zeta-Jones.
Just in case there was any confusion whatsoever.
Yeah, you don't
want to
be confused between the two Catherine Zeta-Joneses.
You know what? And hearkening back to how much this movie kind of blatantly rips off Indiana Jones, do you know what her character's name is? Did you happen to catch that?
Oh, yeah.
Sala.
Yeah, she's Sala.
She's the vaguely Middle Eastern character in this movie named Sala. Interesting.
Now, it's funny. We have these two really powerful women, mm-hmm. and we have women as threats in this movie. Mm-hmm.
Yes, sky pirates, which is really cool.
And then we have an element to this movie that we'll get into that is decidedly unfeminist.
Very.
I kind of ruined this movie for you.
A little bit, because there are multiple moments.
Want to get into it now?
Look,
or you wanna...
okay, we need to, I will, let's
put a
get
pin
into
in this.
No, let's get into this, because okay. On either side of this table are two people very at odds about this movie. In the one corner, you have myself, who loves this movie unabashedly. Yes, I recognize it has flaws. Great. But I legit love this movie. And on the other side of the table is my colleague, Mr. Cargill.
Who legitimately likes this movie.
Who legitimately... I guess we're not at as much at odds as I thought, but the degree to which we like this movie is what varies.
Oh, yes, yes. Quite a... Like, I think this is a fun flick. I have fun with it. I've watched it several times. This is the first time I've revisited it in a while. Watched it, enjoyed it quite a bit again. But I do not have the passion for it that you do. But then again, they came to us at very different times in our lives.
Sure.
This came to me when I was in my early 20s,
yeah.
And I'd already seen a bunch of movies like this. Film was shifting. We just had Pulp Fiction. You know, movies were coming more gritty and about reality and rooted in that. And indie film was great. And this was kind of the last gasp of Hollywood going, we don't know what you guys want anymore. So we're going to keep trying stuff like this. And it was fun, and it's great junk food. You, however, this movie came to you at just the right age.
The absolute perfect age.
And it was exactly what you wanted at that point. Like, had this movie come out in, like, 1984, this would probably be one of my movies where I'm like, fuck you, The Phantom's awesome. I wouldn't be like, oh, hey, this movie's a little rapey.
Yeah.
Because this movie's a little rapey.
Okay, and it's what I'm saying is, pursuant to our name, Junk Food Cinema, I must... And also with respect to our shades of differing opinions on how much we like this movie, which is really not that different at all, I will acknowledge some of the flaws of this movie, some of which I had locked and loaded, one of which I will admit fully did not dawn on me until I watched it with this asshole who proceeded to cosbify, which is a term I'm coining.
It has been cosbified.
He cosbified this movie by pointing out the sheer... plethora of scenarios suggesting rape and or some other form of sexual assault against the only two women in the goddamn movie.
But you know what? The thing is, I'm not going to go as far as to point that element out because, no, rape is mentioned involving... three of the main characters. One
this
of them
is true.
A man.
This is true.
There's a moment where Catherine Zeta-Jones is just like, bring back his body for me.
They're gonna interrogate Kit Walker, and she goes, I claim the body when you're done. And no one even, my favorite part of that scene, no one even fucking looks in her direction, which means one of two things. Either this happens so much in this culture that they are completely desensitized to it, or possibly more frightening, she specifically has done this before. This is part of this gang's modus operandi.
Yeah, but no, the sheer amount of sexual violence, like, threatened against characters, you know, just like, I'm going to come, you know, they've got Christy Swanson tied to a chair and they're interrogating her. And then, you know, we've got James Remar like, I'm going to come back.
We'll have a little fun later.
We'll have a little fun later and spend some, we'll have some time alone and have a little fun.
We'll have a little fun trying to close this gap.
And it's like, and like every time Christy Swanson is introduced to some new bad guy, that bad guy just wants to bone her against her will, and this movie's like fine with that.
It happens so often that it actually changes the allegiance of one of the characters.
Oh yeah,
there is a moment where one of the pirates of the Sang Brotherhood goes up to Christy Swanson like, this one's mine, and Catherine Zeta-Jones knees him in the nuts and then says to Christy Swanson, we girls need to stick together. So
and then she becomes a good guy.
Yeah.
Because she's like, you know what? This movie, I wanted to rape a corpse, but
I'm not okay with that.
Even worse.
I am not okay with pirate rape.
Pirate rape is outright, and this movie's gone one rape too far, and we're moving on. Now, there's no actual rape in the movie.
No, but it's just...
It's a lot of threatened rape.
It is heavy in the air. Rape is heavy in the air of this movie.
I can feel it. Come and
stop. You could have just stopped it coming. So that is admittedly a problem with this movie, that literally there's a catchphrase.
Yeah. Oh, here it goes.
That as we were talking about this, the movie's going on, and one of the very last lines of the movie, I shit you not, and I literally like looked at Cargill and I was like,
you were so mad.
I was so mad because I realized I would never be able to look at this movie the same way again. One of the taglines, not taglines, one of the catchphrases that Billy Zane drops at the end is, he says,
oh, yeah.
You know, I can only show my true face to the woman I intend to marry. And she goes, well, what if she refuses? And he actually says, and he says this independent of any knowledge of the heavy rape culture of this movie, says, no one refuses the Phantom. He might as well have said, no one refuses the Phantom.
Let me pour you a drink. I'll make you drink. You'll become the mother of the next Phantom.
Yeah.
Which, by the way.
Yeah, okay. That's the other problem with this movie. We got to. Okay, let's move on from rape for a second. Like, let's get out of the Phantom frat house for a second and talk about the very construct of this character that.
Slam bro fists.
Slam consent. No, the very conceit of this character is baffling to me because at the beginning of the movie, the very Raiders of the Lost Ark sequence, which, by the way, is super awesome. Like, it just feels very much like that old school rough and tumble adventure stuff that I love. Like, the stunt work in this movie is not fancy. it's not like a craft cocktail with weird like crushed up mulled ginger or nothing's been vaporized, but it's like the smooth old fashioned your grandfather's scotch neat. That's what the stunt work in this movie is. And I love it.
No, and it's great. And it, one of the nice things about it is you could tell it's real stunt work doing, you know, in real locations because they do them in slow-mo.
Yeah.
Like, it's not so, like, when he's swinging, when he shoots a vine and swings on the vine with someone on there.
With Short Round.
They run that shit in slow-mo so that you can enjoy, hey, by the way, check this shit out. Isn't this cool? The movie does that a couple of times, and it does that because there's some really cool stunt work in here. That's one of the things. This is one of those movies that is so in love with its era that it's even in love with the kind of craft that goes into that.
Exactly.
And it's going back and, you know, relishing the rape culture and the stunt work culture of the 1930s.
Yeah. Yeah. One of those things is good. And it's the stunt work. But like, there's a lot of stunts that involve just somebody hanging onto a car door of a speeding truck or, you know, or the pontoons of a seaplane or, you know, there's a lot of horse stunt work. I mean, it's very like to the point that I expected to see Douglas Fairbanks' name in the credits. Like, that's how old school the stunt work in this movie feels. And it's good. And it's all of the fight sequences. It's a lot of haymakers, a lot of just like just brutal barroom punching. It's not fancy. It's a little clunky at times, but it just seems like, you know, like a drunken Lee Marvin in a bar brawl kind of fights. And I am all for that.
Yeah.
But going back to my problem with the character is prior to those guys showing up, stealing the skull and happen to have had a connection to Xander Drax in New York. The Phantom just sits in the skull cave and what, waits for bad things to come to him in Bengala? It seems like a very specific and possibly unnecessary superhero gig that he literally sits on a giant stone skull throne and just waits for trouble to enter the jungle. And had that skull been kept somewhere else, the Phantom would still be sitting in that cave pretty much for the rest of his life. And in fact, I think that's confirmed by the fact that his father, the previous Phantom, is revealed to have been murdered by James Remar. So apparently, if it's not for James Remar, none of the Phantoms leave Bengala. They all just stay there.
That's how, A, nobody's heard of the fucking Phantom in the rest of the world. And B, his job is he's the defender of the jungle. Like, that is what he does.
The jungle, which is mostly inhabited by natives and, like, six British guys at a base who work with him. So who is he protecting? Who is he protecting the jungle from?
Well, here's, if that's really what's baking your noodle right now, let me hit you with some math, motherfucker.
Oh, I love it when we bring math into this podcast.
Bring math into this. How long has the Phantom been in existence?
Since 1936.
No.
Oh, since 400
years.
Yeah.
They actually say for 400 years,
right.
Phantom has protected 400 years. There have been 20 Phantoms at this point. The average lifespan of someone as the Phantom is 20 years.
No, that's not true, because his father was in his 60s, according to his headstone or whatever, after, like...
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that means some other poor Phantom was Phantom for, like, a week before his son had to take over the mantle.
There's got
to
be, like, a William Henry Harrison of the Phantoms, right?
The math is 20... 400 divided by 20 is 20.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
You spend 20 years as the Phantom on average before somebody fucking kills you, takes your belt, and then your son has to avenge you.
What do you think the retirement package is like for the Phantom? I mean, they have a shit ton of...
The retirement package, you get to be a ghost in a cave giving shit to your son. Yeah. That's the retirement package.
Okay, that is actually one of my favorite elements of this movie, is Patrick McGoohan as the ghost of his father who just hangs around and gives him shit all the time. It's like this weird little back and forth repartee that they have.
And you get the impression that his dad did the exact same shit to him, and he's like, this is fun.
Yeah.
Like, this is retirement, is death hanging out in this fucking cave giving my son shit.
Even in death, you can't leave this fucking cave.
But then he does, because he shows up in a cab in New York City.
It's just, oh, I just it's like a union job. It's like a union superhero. So all I got to do is sit here. I don't have. I just sit here and watch this. Watch the throne. Really, that's what I'm doing. Okay.
I feel like if Superman had showed up to fight someone there, that's where you know the Phantom comes out. Goes whoa.
No, this is my turf.
Soups. This is a. Are you part of the union? Are you part of Bengala local? No, you ain't. This is my job. Do not touch that villain. This is my villain in my jungle. I gotta do this. This is union job. This is my job. You are taking work from union men.
That is the that's Cargo with the unplaceable accent theater. But yeah, that's
this is Phantoms, yo.
It is. It's Billy Zane was the bomb in Phantom.
I really, really kind of wanted to just watch Phantoms and then come in and do this as if, you know, not having watched Phantom and being like, wait, the Billy Zane movie? Why would we watch that? No. But you're like, come on over and watch it. I'm like, oh, man, I can't pull that gag now.
I want to talk a little bit about performances in this movie, specifically the performances of Billy Zane and Treat Williams as Xander Drax. X-A-N-D-E-R-D-R-A-X. It begins and ends with the letter X. Xander Drax is the character, basically, in terms of kind of outlandishness of performance, that Billy Zane had just played in Tales from the Crypt, in so much as he is chewing scenery like the set is made of gingerbread. And he's doing it to a degree that he actually saves moments of this movie. He plays, his character plays everything so grandiose. And is so in awe of everything that he actually saves moments where if he wasn't playing it so over the top, you would notice that the things going on in that scene aren't that spectacular. For example, when they get the second skull in the museum, all that's happening is somebody's flicking the lights on and off and breaking a couple windows. If that was the full demonstration of power of these skulls, you'd be like, they're not that powerful. But in the meantime, you have Treat Williams standing in the middle of it going, it's amazing! Show me the power! It's insane! Like, you're just like, well, I guess it is, because he's clearly out of his mind. So this must be... So I think he actually elevates moments that would otherwise be really paltry by virtue of his completely ridiculous performance. Meanwhile, because that niche is being filled by Treat Williams, Billy Zane, who had in his previous film been that over-the-top and that scenery-chewing... has this, it's not apathy. It's not an apathetic performance. He's got a lot of charm. It's almost like a calculated aloofness. Almost, that reminded me, and on this viewing, I know this is going to sound crazy, reminded me of Elliot Gould in The Long Goodbye, where it seems like he's breezing through his own story with this coolness that just cannot be thwarted, this coolness that can't be phased by any of the weirdness that's going on. And he also has that same sort of like mumbly smug delivery of dialogue. And it was just interesting to juxtapose this with his performance in Tales from the Crypt Demon Knight, where he is the unhinged one, because it's almost like he got to set and went, oh, that guy is the unhinged one, well, I'm gonna adopt and do something completely different. And I think that might be why, and maybe that's a personal thing, but I think that might be why I find him the most charming of, you know, of that group of like Alec Baldwin and Billy Campbell of The Shadow and The Rocketeer, respectively.
No, I love Treat Williams as Xander Drax. He's one of those rare villains where everybody in the movie's like, he's crazy, he's a madman, and then you meet them and they're like perfectly sane, they're just greedy. No, this guy's fucking crazy.
He's a lunatic.
There's this great moment where they're like, oh, hey, I found where we're going. We're going to this island. Well, but isn't that essentially the Bermuda Triangle? Like,
yes,
all these ships.
Aren't you
like,
excited to go?
He's like, yeah, we're going to be the first people to actually go there. And it's uncharted. It's awesome. And everyone's like, what the fuck, dude?
He's kind of like if Howard Hawks and Lex Luthor had a child.
Yeah. And that's what I think exactly what they were going for with this. And you know, how he ends up negotiating in the end. And at the end of the day, you discover Xander Drax is really a shit fucking supervillain.
Oh yeah,
garbage.
No, he is, and that is established very early on. Again, structurally, this movie is very odd because we have a superhero who, for all intents and purposes, just stays in a jungle nobody goes to most of the time, and then on the other side of the coin, we have a villain whose evil plot is obvious to everyone in the city before we even meet the guy. Like, it's not one of those situations like in every other superhero movie where the villain's plot is slowly revealed and that guy is slowly revealed to be evil. No, the minute he walks in frame, there's like 14 guys going, okay, that guy right there is up to something. He's looking for evil artifacts. He's into the occult. I am not trusting this guy. He needs to get out of here. They know before we do that this guy is evil. I'm like, it almost feels like what would happen if we were watching The Phantom 2 and he was back. Like, everyone has that foresight of how evil he is before the audience does, to the point that it feels like a sequel that he's come back for.
Yeah, and so, one of my favorite cheesy parts of this movie is the fact that, you know, we've got, you know, Xander Drax comes to a party, uh-huh. and there's the head of a newspaper who's throwing the party, and he's like, he's calling him out in front of, you know, the police commissioner and in front of some other important political guy and the mayor, and he's like, this guy's evil, I know he's evil, he's up to no good, he's doing this, he's doing this, he's doing this, and they're like, you're being crazy, you're being silly, and then they, a moment later, and they're in the car, and they go, he knows too much.
Yeah, the whole city apparently is in this guy's pocket.
It's not a secret.
Which you would think if every, like, the mayor, the police chief, everybody's in Xander Drax's pocket, it wouldn't be so easy, especially in the pre-internet era, to know everything he's up to. But they do, and apparently it's one guy's fault. It's like, there's apparently one guy in charge of keeping Xander Drax's evil plan a secret. It's this nebbish little accountant guy that he then has to kill because he's not doing his job properly. I have never heard of that before, where you have, like, basically a personal assistant / gatekeeper of your records. Is that a thing that ever existed?
Oh, no. He's the librarian, is what that was.
Wait, hold on.
The librarian went and shared...
Wait a minute. So
he just kills a librarian who told a member of the press what he's been researching.
Wait, but
like, he murders a librarian.
Doesn't that presuppose the idea that everyone's evil, like, schemes are public record? That's so weird to me. It's like, oh, we got to kill the librarian. It's That'll keep my evil plot under wraps.
Well, but, you know, to be fair.
And my connections with the mafia that apparently are also public record.
To be fair, when your hero is a guy who inherits the title, who hangs out in the jungle, you kind of have to make the villain easy for him to make sure. Everything about this plot is simple as fuck. Like, yeah. You know, there's this great moment where Christy Swanson has flown out to meet with this captain who happens to know the Phantom. And she, you know, she's been rescued and she's out there. She's like, I've come all this way to show you this scrap of paper and ask you if you know what it is. Yeah, that's the Mark of the Sang Brotherhood. Oh, okay, thanks. And then he's like, well, we're going to send you home now. No, I came here and I have a job to do and I'm going to see it through. And it's like,
I think you just did it.
You just did it. Like, yeah. You were human Google. Like, you flew half a world away.
You are pre-internet explorer.
What does this mean?
You are pre-internet explorer.
It's the sign of the Sang Brotherhood. Well, what does that mean for the plot? We're like, we don't know, because we don't know what the Sang Brotherhood's up to. We just recognize that tattoo.
Which, by the way, Xander Drax also has a slide of that symbol and says the mark of the Pirates of the Sang Brotherhood. If we know that he's been researching this in the library, which is why he had to kill the librarian, why the fuck didn't they just go to the library and see if they could find that symbol? Why did they have to fly her halfway across the goddamn planet?
Yeah, why did they just know that symbol's involved?
Don't be fooled by what we're saying. This movie is awesome.
It is.
Do not let us sound like we're disparaging this movie. It is awesome.
Oh, we
awesome.
Are disparaging this movie, but because we like this movie, hey, and we love it despite its flaws.
This is the only superhero movie featuring a scene where a horse talks to a goddamn dog.
And the dog speaks to the horse, and they have a conversation.
It is like the setup of a joke, where it's like a dog walks up to a horse and says, but they actually fucking, like, and I don't mean that, like, celebrities come in and voice them. I mean, there is, like, a William Girdler level of collusion that is established by them standing next to each other, and the horse takes off like, okay, I've got it, I'm on my way.
And I love how the Phantom lives in the jungle and has a connection with the animals of the jungle, and his only two animals are domesticated animals from the Americas.
Neither of which, neither of which I believe are native to Africa. I don't believe the wolf or the white stallion are native African species, but I could be wrong. I'm not an animalologist.
Yeah, well, when you have a rich white guy superhero living in the jungle, he's going to have rich white guy pets.
That's
he's kind of like, he's just like the Michael Jackson of the jungle.
He does have a lot of bones around. Bye!
And a skin-tight lavender bodysuit.
I want to address this. I want to address this whole...
Is the rape thing again?
No,
I think
no,
we covered that.
No, we're good on that. We're not,
rape evil.
We're done with that. We're so done with that. I want to talk a little bit about the Phantom character because, you know, you are astute in pointing out the connections to Batman and the similarities to Batman. This is something that ever since I started watching these movies, The Shadow and The Phantom and of course, the Batman movies of the 90s, has always kind of interested me. And I also am fortunate enough to have a father who is very much into old-time radio, specifically The Shadow. And so just kind of gathering all this knowledge from him and doing some research, The Phantom was created in 1936. It was a comic strip first released in 1936. Bob Kane creates Batman in 1939. So and the Shadow first appears on the radio in 1930. So I mean it would be easy to just kind of trace a line. Oh, 1930, 36. So Batman is kind of an amalgam of the Shadow and the Phantom, right?
Yeah, mixed with how Superman looked.
Yeah. But here's the thing. Go back to 1920, and 1919 was actually the creation of a character named Zorro. And Zorro, part of the Zorro backstory, which was created and then immediately turned into a movie with Tyrone, I believe the first one was Tyrone Power, Mark of Zorro. That character, Diego de la Vega, pretends to be a rich fop, a rich dandy, so that he can, by night, be Zorro and protect the poor. There's a lot of, I think a lot, this is kind of a trickle-down situation where we start with Zorro and a lot of...
We start with Mexican labor and then we slowly move into
not trickle-down,
white guys
appropriating
it.
No. This is not NAFTA, okay? This is the trickle-down theory of superheroes that starts,
right,
I
Reagan,
believe...
All right, tell us about the trickle-down superhero theory.
I believe it starts with Zorro and then kind of moves down to the Shadow and you start seeing all of these elements that are then... refined and created within these new characters that eventually culminates into Batman. And a lot of those elements from the Phantom comic are maintained in this movie. In fact, one of the more clever adaptation moments of the comic strip is at the very beginning of the movie. It starts with a title card that says, "For those who came in late," which was how every Phantom comic strip started. It was just a little bubble in the left-hand corner that said, "For those who came in late," kind of playing on the fact that, I mean, comic strips, when you're telling an adventure story in comic strip form, it's essentially a printed serial. I mean, you're going through, you know, a story little by little. And there's a lot of other, like, the Pirates of the Singing Brotherhood was the very first foe that the Phantom faced. The origin story is largely the same, although in the original origin story, this is interesting, the young boy swears an oath to the shaman of Tuganda, not on the ring, but on the skull of his father's murderer. Like, super dark. they have found and killed his father's murderer, and he swears this oath to the shaman on the skull of his father's murderer. But like the elements in this movie, like the fact that he's got a butler, he's got his own cave. His butler has medical training,
so he's skull cave,
always patching him up. And then he's got the one local law enforcement person in the entire country is someone who's working with him, very much a Commissioner Gordon-like character. But what I find very interesting...
And has very Batman moments where, yeah, like, when the Phantom just shows up in his room, he's like, you know, you could use the door.
He's like, I like the window. And again, with that Billy Zane kind of smug aloofness that's actually, despite itself, very charming. She's like, oh, yeah, I like the window. I'm cool. And which is hilarious to me that he can sneak up on anyone because, guys, he is wearing a purple body condom. How in the fucking jungle is he sneaking up on anyone? But that's not the point. What I find interesting is that in the comic strip for the Phantom, the idea of the character who... There's a character in this movie named Jimmy who's kind of... not even really the romantic rival because the heroine doesn't pay him the time of day.
Doesn't like him at all.
Doesn't like him. He's very sleazy.
By the way... just to kind of tie this all back together.
Oh, God, he's rapey, isn't he? He's... oh, God damn it.
The first scene we see him, he kisses her against her own will.
Oh, it's worse than that. He says, I had this urge to find you in the Yukon and
burst into your tent.
Burst into your tent or log cabin and sweep you off your feet. So take her against her will. And then she says, why didn't you? And you remember his answer was, after a couple of gin fizzes and a cold shower, the urge passed. What the fuck, Phantom movie?
And then he goes and kisses her just on the mouth when she wants nothing to do with it. Oh, yeah, so rapey boyfriend, because there wasn't enough rape in this movie for you.
Anyway.
I can't wait until you watch this movie again.
I may never watch this fucking movie again without a whistle around my neck. That character in the comic strip was planned. The plan was by the creator.
You rape whistle.
Yeah. The plan in the comic books was that that character was going to be revealed to be the Phantom. In the early comic strips, it was not revealed who the Phantom was. And they were building the creator of, I'm blanking on his name now, unfortunately, but the creator had this idea to slowly reveal that that character, who is very much a rich fop, is the one who's actually... But then the Kit Walker character was created, and they slowly wrote that Jimmy character out. So even in this movie, there is that sort of Bruce Wayne facade. It just it is harkening back to the comics where the Bruce Wayne facade that was supposed to be revealed ended up getting written out.
You know, I never read the early ones. I read some of the later stuff when because there was a big Phantom resurgence in the 80s. I read a bunch of stuff then, but I never read the early stuff. So early on, the audience didn't even know who the Phantom
exactly.
was. That's actually cool.
Yeah, no, I think that's very cool. It keeps like a level of mystery, which, I mean, again, makes sense if you think about the fact that they're telling the story in, what, 4 or 5 panel chunks. You got to keep something from the audience to keep them coming back every week to that newspaper and reading it again and again. And I think it said at one point there were as many as 100 million people reading every week The Phantom. And it's still printed to this day from what I mean, I don't know what papers are still running it, but apparently there are papers still running The Phantom to this day. It is one of the most popular comic strips that was ever created.
It's a big hit in the Agrippa Times.
Yeah, in the Agrippa Times, very much so. I will say this about Billy Zane and his commitment to this movie. This is why I refuse to call his performance lazy. He's very committed to this role. They created the original Phantom suit to have fake muscles because they didn't believe that Billy Zane would be able to put on enough body mass and muscle to fill it out. They had to redesign the suit because by the time, you know, a year later when they came to shoot it, he had put on a ridiculous amount of muscle. He had been working out for an entire year, and they were like, oh no, he's legitimately built now. We don't have to fake the muscles.
And it's funny, you know, this is one of those things that they actually show them off in a scene. They have a very muscle scene, and then he's wearing this skin-tight suit. It's interesting because this movie came out 3 years before Fight Club would change the way we thought about what men's body is supposed to look like in a movie.
Mm-hmm.
So he's in ridiculously good shape here.
Yeah.
But you look at it now and you're like, oh, well, you know, he's not exactly Brad Pitt in Fight Club. Like, he doesn't have that lean, like,
carved out of wood
thing that we have, like, now of, like, the, yes, there isn't an ounce of fat on my body. I ate nothing but chicken and rice for 12 weeks and lifted, you know, hay bales.
Interesting.
But when you look at the suit, it's not at all what you'd see in a superhero movie today. Like, you know, you look at The Watchmen, you look at, you know, you look at Superman, you look at what the guys look like in Dawn of Justice coming up. Ridiculously different from the standards of the 90s,
sure,
where this guy who's in ridiculously good shape you and I will never be in.
Though I have tried.
You slapped us together and you could make and pulled apart the flesh. You could make 4 Billy Zanes.
Is that another rape joke? I'm so confused.
There's a lot of rape jokes in this episode.
I'm completely befuddled by this.
This episode
brought to you by Pudding Pops.
You're going to have to ask for consent at the beginning of this episode.
Yeah, we may have
to. Are you sure you want to listen to this? Are you sure?
Are you sure?
Are you cool? Are you sober?
You can say no at any time. Sure? You can hit the stop button at any time, literally.
You don't have to listen to the rest of this.
Literally.
This rape-tastic episode.
Trying very hard to move us away from
rape
this ape. Topic.
Grape
rape ape in that purple suit. This movie was originally going to be the first of a trilogy, but it did bomb at the box office, so they never revisited it. And
How bad did it bomb?
I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but I wonder if that... Because I don't feel like that mentality really existed yet in the 90s. I mean, we had the Batman movies that were kind of a franchise, but even then, from movie to movie, you had different actors playing Batman. You had they feel so disconnected.
The whole idea of creating franchises was not a thing. In the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, having franchises was great, but you didn't think about a franchise until a movie was a hit. That's how audiences thought about it. We didn't have
it. Wasn't a foregone conclusion.
There wasn't something like you had at the end of Deadpool where they'd come out and make a joke about the sequel.
The idea, it's
one of those things like when we made Sinister, you know, people looked at the ending that we had intended Sinister to be a single film. And people looked at that ending and said, oh, well, that's all about the sequel. I know what the sequel is. And people are already talking about the sequel when we had not wanted to do a sequel. It was that kind of like that mentality exists today that didn't exist back then. So I had no idea that I could have had three Phantom movies in the 90s.
Yeah.
I could have had Salah come back as a hero
in
the subsequent movies with Catherine Zeta-Jones without the hyphen.
Yes,
a hyphen free Catherine Zeta-Jones.
We could have returned to the Playboy Mansion. Oh yeah, by the way, the Palmer Mansion where Diana Palmer's father lives is the actual Playboy Mansion that they digitally kind of inserted with. Well, not digitally; they just used a bunch of fucking scrims to make it look like it was in New York. But that's actually the Playboy Mansion. That's kind of hilarious to me. One of the things you might notice right off the bat from the closing credits, aside from the lack of Nick Fury trying to recruit the Phantom into the Defenders of the Earth, is
Defenders of the Earth
is the names of the producers on this movie.
Oh, there are two uber producers on this movie.
Yeah.
One that Junk Food Cinema fans will be like, hell yeah. And the other will be like, really?
Yeah.
Hell yeah.
And really? The hell yeah is the once and future director of this movie, which the guy that was originally signed on to direct this movie, someone by the name of Joe Dante.
Little Joey Dante.
But it says he left due to other commitments. And before that, you know, this is terrifying. Joe Dante would have been cool, but the terrifying bullet we dodged was who was considered before Joe Dante. Joel Schumacher. He would have ruined the Phantom before there was a Phantom to ruin on screen.
I don't know that for sure.
I'm sorry. Like after pretty much outside of the 80s, Joel Schumacher to me just I can't do it.
Oh my god. Junk Food Alarm, future episode alarm.
What?
We got to do Falling Down, a Joel Schumacher film from the 90s.
That's Joel Schumacher?
Fucking awesome. Yes, that's a Joel Schumacher, and we'll do an episode on Schumacher at some point because Joel Schumacher has moments of pure genius. You cannot write him off. He made movies that were amazing in the 70s, in the 80s, in the 90s, in the 2000s. And in between there, he made movies so god awful that you want to hate him, but then you see movies like Falling Down and you can't. I kind of want to know how crazy Joel Schumacher's Phantom would be. Because here's the thing about, and Schumacher has talked about this. Schumacher did on the Batman movies what they told him to do. And his argument was, look, they paid me $8 million to direct each movie. When you pay someone $8 million, you're not paying them to do whatever they want. You're paying them to do what you want. And, you know, the argument, you know, that Harry Knowles particularly made to him was, no, they're paying you to tell them to fuck off. They're paying you to make a good movie and to filter out their bad ideas. So the question is had he directed this with someone like Joe Dante working as a producer behind the scenes and some of these other producers, would he have made a genius version of this movie? Or would he have given us, you know, a Phantom suit with nipples? Like,
yeah, I'm sorry. I don't buy that the studio was to blame for Batman and Robin and Batman Forever when they were sent the dailies of Batman and Robin every day and were without the sound. They had no idea what the fuck was actually going on set. But just from seeing the dailies, we're like, oh, let's sign him on to do another one with the Scarecrow and we'll have Jeff Goldblum play
him. These are the people that did choose to go with Arnold Schwarzenegger over Patrick Stewart.
No,
Mr. Freeze. No,
and I understand that the studio, that particular studio, has made a wealth of bad decisions. I just don't. I refuse to believe that the nipples on the bat suits was a mandate from fucking Warner Brothers and a number of other things.
The nipples, everyone likes to joke about the nipples in the bat suit. Nipples in the bat suit are bad. Far from the worst thing about either of those movies.
Oh, I'm aware. I have nightmares about some of the worst things in those movies. But all that being said, I was trying to, in that interim, research what Joe Dante may have left to work on. And I'm wondering, I mean, it's kind of a stretch because it was 2 years later, but Small Soldiers did require a lot of pre-production and a lot of puppet work and a lot of
one of his best movies,
and it's
too.
An amazing movie. So I'm wondering if that may have been the movie
that wasn't on either of our lists.
No,
this
it wasn't,
weekend, and it needs to be.
Well, we'll definitely do that.
Yeah, junkies, we actually had an email exchange this weekend where we each sent each other a list of 30 movies we wanted to talk about.
Yeah,
we now have a list of like the next year's movies.
Yes. So fear not.
We may sew them all together in a month. We may just fucking go random and just go commando for the rest of the year. We don't know yet. We just don't know.
But The Phantom is a movie that I think has some silly moments. It has some effects that don't quite hold up. But those things are so few and far between. And the bulk of the movie is just a great old-fashioned swashbuckling adventure story with some really fantastic classic stunts. And it's got a villain that is like the beautiful type of over the top that we hope for in movies like this. And you have a hero who is just charming despite himself, and really just like the camera loves Billy Zane in this movie.
The camera actually loves everyone in this movie.
Oh, that's yeah.
I mean, Christy Swanson is adorable with her tomboyish charm in this. Mm-hmm. Catherine Zeta-Jones is never more beautiful than she was in this movie.
Agree with that.
And the character of Sala is one of the most interesting characters of this genre, because she's so despicable and so evil, and you just want to smack the shit out of her for the first 4/5 of this movie, and then when she makes the turn, you're like, oh wait, she's on our side now? Rock on.
Yeah.
Like, cool. She's like the necrophiliac is one of us. Awesome. And you're like down with it. Like Christy Swanson flies off with Catherine Zeta-Jones and you're like, fuck yeah.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, it's like choose your rapist, Christy Swanson. Like stick around with the Nobody Refuses the Phantom, or go off with I Want His Body When You're Done.
Yeah.
So like, it's not like she had much choice.
She may have been better off with the pirates. And I mean things like that. Things like a cast that includes Billy Zane, Christy Swanson, Treat Williams, Catherine Zeta-Jones, James Remar, David Provall, who is one of my favorite actors that turns up in everything, Monster Squad, Vice Versa, The Sopranos. Kerry Tagawa from Mortal Kombat as the evil Kabai Sang, who talks very much through the top of his mouth. You can't stop. It's like you're gonna have to stop spitting at me. And all of those things kind of combined make you forgive the weird structural like components of this movie and the lethargy of the villains and the heroes, where we have a hero who sits in a skull cave waiting for danger to find him, and a bunch of pirates living in a completely uncharted island, and their actual ship is inside the island, so they're not sailing anywhere. They're basically camped out inside the Pirates of the Caribbean ride at Disney World. It's the only villains lair I've ever seen that has its own gift shop. It is ridiculous.
You know, there is one thing I want to share, just one moment
share
that I wish was slightly different.
Okay.
Because they have the perfect setup in the third act to go fully crazy pants. And they don't. They stayed very milquetoast with your third acts, which for a very fun third act. I mean, there's some great kills. There's some great swashbuckling adventure. I love the fact that they set the end of the film on the Pirates of the Caribbean ride. That was kind of amazing.
Yeah.
But no, they have this moment where Treat William walks in and has this moment where he's like, I brought the two skulls. I found them. Ha ha. And there's a weird look on the villain's face. And in that moment, I've always wanted him to go, you what? Do you know how long we've been trying to keep these apart? Like, are you serious?
Dude, what the fuck are you doing?
We're protecting the reason this island is uncharted and the reason we have it here is so that nobody can bring all three of them together. Are you fucking nuts? And then they're, you know, I kind of wanted that. And then a moment later, they're like, oh, hey, you like the Phantom? Well, we got his girlfriend. And I wanted him to kind of flip out even more there. You what? You brought, do you, he's coming. Like, if you brought her here, like, we keep killing him and he keeps coming back.
Just Cab by saying, teaching Treat Williams how to be a villain.
Everyone in this cave apparently has been able to kill one of these phantoms because they apparently only lived for 20 years. And we've all killed the phantom, which makes no sense whatsoever since very few of them are old at all.
I thought about that. I think I have an explanation for that. I think it's because they all keep thinking that he's dead. Like, James Remar thinks he's killed Billy Zane, too. Even after the difference between his father and Billy Zane, he still thinks he's killed Billy Zane at one point, too. I think part of it is, yes, it's a hereditary mantle, but part of it is that he's just really tough to kill, but he might fall out of the truck while it's moving, and if you assume he's dead, then that's really on you. I mean,
yeah, and
that's
you've
really
seen
your
him
fault.
Actually die, and he keeps coming back from other things, you're like, oh, no, I've killed this guy like 4 or 5 times already.
Who was that guy?
Somebody I already killed.
It's kind of like, you know, when you make your girlfriend come, it's like, oh, yeah, she came 4 or 5 times. It's great. It's just, it becomes a, hey, did she make a sound? Oh, yeah, I'll make the assumption.
Yeah. It's really hubris. It's villainous hubris is what we're talking about.
But aside from that, you know, I kind of want those two moments in there because I think that would be like, that would just be really great.
For sure.
But because that would to further the myth of the Phantom, because that's the Phantom superpower. And that's what's the most interesting thing about this character and this film is they do such a great job of handling the mythology. Because the Phantom's one superpower is that everyone believes he's immortal and everybody's scared and impressed as shit at this guy, regardless of how unimpressive his shit is. Like, you know, when he does something unimpressive, people are like, oh, shit. He just appeared in my house. He's like, dude, I climbed in the fucking window.
Yeah.
Like, that's like, it's we're out in the middle of Avery. You don't
you
have
might
locks
say
in your
he
window.
Strikes fear in the hearts of his opponents. You might say that deception is a powerful ally. Yeah, the Batman parallels are pretty apparent.
Oh yeah, but then you have, you know, there's that great moment at the end where Christy Swanson asks Billy Zane, you know, does your servant know? And he's like, of course. He just likes calling me Ghost That Walks.
Yeah, he calls him he doesn't call him Phantom. He doesn't call him Kit. He calls him Ghost Who Walks.
Because he buys into perpetuating the story. Like, that's the whole point of the Phantom, is he's a story. That's it. And this guy is caught up in this story. And I love that. And and I think it's such a great concept. And I think it's such a well-executed, fun adventure, campy,
sure,
throwback movie. It's so good at what it does. I don't think it's as good as The Rocketeer, but I think it's heads and shoulders above The Shadow.
See, I am of the completely different. Wait, that's really interesting to me because I think going into this movie, I mean, even still, I like this movie a lot more than you do, but I still like The Shadow better than this one. Even though I like the female character in this better than any of them, and I think Billy Zane has the most charm, in terms of a movie, I still think The Shadow is the best one. So that's really interesting how we've arrived at that. But regardless, get out your rings and start slamming evil today. And consent is always important, guys. Do not forget about that.
Yeah, don't show somebody this movie without telling them what you're showing them first.
Yeah.
Make sure you get their consent.
Yeah, tell them, make sure they know.
This movie won't.
Don't deceive them. Make sure they know it's not Ben Affleck and Phantoms.
See, that's, you know, and let's just wrap that up real quick.
Okay.
That's the thing, is nobody actually gets raped in this movie.
No.
There's no allusion to anyone actually having that, but there's
an awful lot
of threats.
Yeah.
And a lot of, you know, like, just a lot of people wanting to take other people without them consenting. That is just
it's, you know what it
is, never happened today.
It has a very pre-rape vibe, like that uneasy feeling you get right before something really terrible goes down, that you feel like, maybe I shouldn't be here, I should probably leave. There, that feeling permeates a lot of this movie. It's
here's the thing that you guys
we like this movie.
Here's the thing you folks need to understand now. We now have crossed into 2016. We are in the second half of this decade.
We are
in the teens. We are well into the teens, which means we have now gotten to the point in history where when we look back at the 90s, we have to apologize and go, well, it was a different time.
Yeah, it's a different time than illustrating a further different time. So it's like archaicception.
Yeah,
at that point,
it's like in the 90s it was totally okay to threaten women with rape as long as you didn't actually rape them.
As long
that
as
would
you,
be wrong.
As long as you were presenting the 30s idea that it was okay to threaten,
because just simply saying I'll come back and we'll have some time alone, you were complimenting a woman. You were telling her that if we were to be alone and you were not to consent, I would
have
interested
my way with you.
So this is the 90s, folks. is the evil slamming phantom. God bless it and all of its stupid, awesome, delightful glory. Oh, wait. Oh, I'm going to rewind.
Okay.
We left them on a cliffhanger, which was very appropriate for the phantom.
What?
We only talked about one of the two really special producers in this.
Oh, yeah. The other producer is Hollywood nefarious legend himself, Robert Goddamn Evans. Robert Evans
produces
The Godfather and The Last Picture Show and some of the greatest films of all time, and is also himself a complete
Rosemary's Baby,
a complete wackadoo of a human being, but has some of the greatest old Hollywood stories you will ever hear this side of You Must Remember This podcast. Like, it is crazy the stories that guy has. And if you've ever seen the documentary The Kid Stays in the Picture, which I highly recommend, holy shit Robert Evans. But yeah, he's one of the producers of The Phantom. I don't understand. I live in a world where all of these ingredients came together to create something as odd and satisfying
and delightful.
And delightful as The Phantom. Hooray.
Yeah. You know, and really, Billy Zane is one of those guys who this was his moment. Like, this was his moment. And I really feel like, I don't know what really happened. I want to say that Titanic kind of killed his career because he was so detestable in Titanic.
Wouldn't that be?
That everybody, you know, you just after, because that's the thing is when Billy Zane was playing the devil, you're like, oh, that devil's fucking awesome. And when he's playing, you know, Kit, you know, the Phantom, you're like, oh, he's so gosh, golly, shucks, likable and smug at the same time. And then it's like, oh, he's got the most punchable face in the world. So by the time, four years after Titanic comes out December 97. Here we are, September 2001, and he's a joke in Zoolander. Like, he is, oh, it's Billy Zane. Like, it's, you know, he's no longer leading movies.
Yeah, almost the assumption of that joke is like, oh, it's D-list actor Billy Zane.
Yeah.
Which is unfair. It's an unfair label.
It's a very unfair label. And he's so great in this. He's so great in Demon Knight. He's so great as the detestable villain in Titanic.
Again, self-hating affluent,
Yes, you really, really want to punch that motherfucker in the jaw for the whole fucking movie.
And he's got a major jaw to punch. He's got a Don Draper like jaw.
Oh yeah, no. He's got a superhero jawline
for sure.
Like, that's the thing is, you know, and but yeah, he's really great here. He's really likable. In fact, that's the thing is between the four 30s era superhero movies.
You're adding
movies,
Dick Tracy.
I'm adding Dick Tracy because Dick Tracy's only a few years before this.
True story.
I find this to be the superior fun adventure movie. It doesn't quite, none of them, well, I love the, I let me say I love the Rocketeer more than this, but I love Kit much more than I love the character of the Rocketeer.
I feel like we may have to do an entirely separate episode just pitting each one of these movies against each other until we come up with an ultimate winner, because there is so much to mine about comparing, you know, the heroes, the villains, comparing the effects, comparing the scores. Obviously Horner's going to win in the score department for Rocketeer.
Oh, of course.
But it's just there's so much to chew on, and we've already gone a little bit long on this episode, but yeah.
As we have been lately.
So
sorry those of you who are like, these guys are like 45 minutes on the dot almost every week. Sometimes
nope.
They hit 50.
Nope.
Now it's just like an hour and
now we
minutes.
Just love the sound of our own voices.
Yeah.
Listen to your friend Billy Zane. He's a cool dude.
So tell us what delightful rape drink we're going to serve people this week.
The junk food pairing is not a rape drink at all. Actually, there was a moment in this film that Cargill pointed out where there's this loving shot of Billy Zane's ass, and it's just like right there, and then they hold it there.
Because it's not just his ass, he jumps up and grabs two villains. With his thighs of steel between, you know, around their necks. Yeah. And
basically Black Widows them.
And yeah.
Xenia Onatops them.
Yeah, it's kind of, except it almost looks like he's about to like go, like, you know when you go to the strip club and the girl puts both legs on your shoulders and then bashes into you because somebody at some point thought that was hot, like having your rib cage broken.
Yes, furthering the uncomfortable sexuality of this movie. Yes, okay, I get it.
We're once again going back to that. Yeah, he's like doing that move to them. Like, he's just jumped up and he's like, I'm going to choke you guys. And then bam, bam. Like it's and there's this moment where you're just sitting there and it's like there's a shot of Billy Zane's ass while his thighs are grabbing two
when
villains.
We say the camera loves Billy Zane, we mean all of Billy Zane. And I remember you mentioned that, and I was like, oh, that's kind of funny. And then I went back and looked at my original article, and the junk food pairing that I picked was a can of Welch's grape soda, not just because it, like the Phantom, is all decked out in purple, but because it is a purple can, much like the purple can of Billy Zane that we have to stare at in the camera. But I am changing that. The junk food pairing for the podcast version is, you will see this shit around Halloween. These little multicolored, and or if you go to any like Stuckey's or Hojo's that has like the shitty candy dispensers, there are sugary candy.
Wait, are we back to last week's again? Are we going back to the candy counter at the?
No. It's the candy skulls that you buy at like bulk stores, or like I said, like the shitty restaurants have in their dispense. Like they look like Day of the Dead skulls, and you can buy them in bulk. They're just like these little tiny, almost taste like sweet tarts. You see them a lot around Halloween. But what struck me about that is the skulls and all the colors. If there is one thing that the Phantom, very much like Batman, understands, it is brand recognition, folks. That skull is on everything he owns. His home is shaped like a skull. He sits in a skull throne.
The MacGuffin of this movie
is,
are a bunch
is
of
finding skulls. There are skulls all over this. He
and
was
none
not...
of them look like real skulls, though. They all look like those candy skulls. Like,
yes.
There isn't a skull.
And
in
they're
this
all
movie.
In different colors because that, I mean, very much like the Batarangs and the Batcomputer, it's all about branding and establishing that brand. And that's what the Phantom is doing, despite the fact that he spends 364 days of the year sitting in a cave in the jungle waiting for something to happen. And that, to me, is impressive. Almost as impressive as the fact that the Phantom in the comic strip, in addition to this purple outfit with all the skulls on it, had a striped pair of underoos outside of his pants. But they did away with that because they thought that would be too silly, folks. That is the one thing they thought audiences would go, you know, that's a little goofy. But so much more of this movie remains. Multicolored sugar skulls that you buy at bulk stores is the junk food pairing for this week's episode. And I hope you have enjoyed it. And I'm going to make this episode run a little bit longer by telling you, Cargill, I don't know if you're aware of this. This week marks the official 2-year anniversary of Junk Food Cinema, the podcast.
Is that why you wanted to slam evil on the anniversary?
I wanted to slam evil all up and down this anniversary. It's our anniversary. I thought we would slam
two
a little
years.
Evil. Yeah, we've been doing this shit for 2 years now.
Back, remember when we were doing it back in our buddy's office?
Yeah.
In this hot, sweltering, terrible corner of an office where we'd just be dripping. Like, what people don't understand is our format was created because we would go into this office and we'd have to turn off the AC because it was so loud.
Yeah.
So we'd be sweating in the Texas spring heat.
Yeah.
And we were just like, you know what? Let's knock this out and get done. And then we would step outside, have a cool drink, air out, and go back in and record another episode.
Yeah.
And now we're here in your swanky man cave.
Yeah. And I don't want to get too mushy, but I will touch upon this briefly, that this podcast, we started it right before I had one of the most difficult periods of my entire life. And this was one of the constants that it was just always I could count on being able to sit down with Cargill and talk about movies I loved. And
You could count on emailing me and not getting a response.
There are just things that I could count on, and now I'm at one of the best places in my life, and we're still doing this show, and it means a lot to me, and I feel like we make a lot of jokes, but if I can get serious for a second, I'm very happy that we're still doing this show, and I'm happy that people are listening, so thank you, Cargill, and thank you, everyone that listens.
That's beautiful, man.
Yeah, no, it's this has been a lot of fun. This is one of those things that, you know, I left film blogging a long time ago. You've recently left film blogging professionally, but this was one of the things that I really have enjoyed doing, and I do it simply. The only reason I do this is because I love sitting around talking about movies with you, and I love the audience that listens to this. You guys really are one of us in a big way. I run into you folks every once in a while. I love whenever I get to run into you folks at conventions or on the road or whatever, sitting down and having a beer with you guys and talking movies, because you guys love movies the way we do, you know, unironically, and that's absolutely It's why we do this. And thank you guys for listening. Thanks for sticking around. Thanks for watching the movies even after we've spoiled them for you. Thanks for watching the movies before we get a chance to spoil them for you. Thanks for sharing this experience with us, because it really does mean so much. It's why I love movies. It's why I make movies. It's what I live for.
For sure.
And you guys are part of that, so thank you so much.
And please continue to support us by rating us and reviewing us on iTunes and subscribing and following us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, liking the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. I'm going to be doing some giveaways this month, so that's very exciting. There's going to be some Junk Food Cinema trivia questions involved with that, some things we've said in previous episodes. So go back and listen to the archives for sure. And Cargill, where can people find you online?
You can find me on Twitter at Massaworm, M-A-S-S-A-W-Y-R-M, or on Facebook, facebook.com/Massaworm.
And you can find me on Twitter at Bry Guy Salisbury, or on Facebook, facebook.com/Brian Salisbury Critic. We're going to end this show on a high note by saying,
Clammy Lizzy.
Yeah, we're going to end on that. I don't know what else to say.